Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
As many of us have been enjoying Labor Day weekend with picnics and time off to spend with family and friends, it's important to remember what Labor Day is all about. President Grover Cleveland signed a congressional act into law back in 1894 to declare Labor Day a national holiday, celebrating workers who have contributed to America's strength. The U.S. Department of Labor's National Labor Hall of Fame honors people and organizations whose contributions in the field of labor have enhanced lives of millions, from pioneering labor union leaders in the 19th century to healthcare workers during the pandemic, who were inducted last year for their role in saving lives. On our show today, we'll have an excerpt from President Joe Biden's speech to workers in Philadelphia. Plus, we'll have highlights of the Biden administration's actions to help workers, including some new initiatives announced just in time for Labor Day. And you'll hear how that contrasts with the former president and presidential contender Donald Trump's record as well. Then we'll have a message from the U.S. Department of Labor on why we celebrate Labor Day. Plus, you'll hear about an anti-union message being sent this weekend from California Republican Carl DeMaio, whose Reform California group wants to put a measure on the ballot that would eliminate some pro-labor laws in our state. From Public News Service, we'll have national news headlines, including more labor updates nationally, an impending strike by Kaiser healthcare workers, right-wing Republican efforts to hold hostage the federal budget unless a vote to impeach President Biden is held, and the question of whether maximum age limits are needed for members of Congress, after some obvious cognitive lapses by both Republican and Democratic senators. Employees in Santee are getting salary raises, and so are the city council members and the mayor. From California News Service, hear about a proposal to address the teacher shortage in California. Then on Destination East County, hear about fall festivities coming up across San Diego's inland region, including Oktoberfests, a Native American powwow, haunting Halloween happenings, comedy shows by Randy Rainbow and Paula Poundstone, the Alley Cat Art Walk, and more. On the second half of our show today, Annette Tour will host our bookshelf segment, and she'll be interviewing Bruce Givner about his book, My Watergate Scandal Tell-All, How I Unwittingly Caused This Historic Event. On Crime Beat, we'll have news about an undercover sting by the Regional Auto Theft Task Force that has resulted in recovery of many stolen vehicles, as well as 50 arrests right here in East County. And finally, on Sounds of History, you'll hear about four bridges in East County that are being renamed to honor historic pioneers in San Diego's backcountry. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. During a Labor Day speech in Philadelphia, President Joe Biden spoke to union workers, praised labor unions, and criticized his predecessor, Donald Trump, for having the worst record on jobs since Herbert Hoover during the Great Depression.
When I ran for president, I told you I'd have your back. And I have. You know, there are a lot of politicians in this country who don't know how to say the word union. They talk about labor, they don't say union. It's union. I'm one of them. I'm proud to say union. I'm proud to be the most pro-union president according to the experts about in American history. And that's my, and by the way, I make no bones about that. Folks, in this Labor Day, let me tell you what we're celebrating. We're celebrating jobs, good paying jobs. Jobs you can raise a family on, union jobs. You've heard me say it before, but my dad used to have an expression, I swear to God. He'd say, Joey, a job's about a lot more than a paycheck, for real. It's about a lot more than a paycheck. It's about your dignity. It's about respect. It's about being able to look your kid in the eye and say, it's going to be okay and mean it when you say it. And he was right. And I'm determined to make that a reality for every family in this country. And we are making it a reality. Nearly 13,500,000 jobs just since you got me sworn in January 2020. 800,000 new manufacturing jobs. But you wouldn't know from all the negative news you hear, but we're getting through this one of the greatest job creation periods in American history. For real, that's a fact. And you know, it wasn't that long ago we were losing jobs in this country. In fact, the guy who held this job before me was just one of two presidents in history. He was one of, but here's an important point, one of two presidents in history that left office with fewer jobs in America than when he got elected office. By the way, you know who the other one was? Herbert Hoover. Isn't that kind of coincidental? Look, but we're turning things around because of you. When the last guy was here, you were shipping jobs to China. Now we're bringing jobs home from China. When the last guy was here, your pensions were at risk. We helped save millions of pensions with your help. When the last guy was here, he looked at the world from Park Avenue. I look at it from Scranton, Pennsylvania. I look at it from Claymont, Delaware. Not a joke. You can't have the strongest economy in the world with a second-rate infrastructure. Can you believe we used to have the best infrastructure in the world? And then we fell to number 13 in the world, roads, bridges, internet, the whole deal. 13, the United States of America, 13th in the world. But guess what? Guess what? The great real estate builder, the last guy here, he didn't build a damn thing. Under my predecessor, Infrastructure Week became a punchline. On my watch, infrastructure has been a decade and it's a headline. Let me tell you. America's best days are ahead of us. They're ahead of us, not behind us. It's about the future. This is about the future. And Lee, I can honestly say, I've been doing this a long while, but I've never been more optimistic about America's future. We just have to remember who we are. We are the United States of America. There's nothing beyond our capacity if we work together. So God bless you all, and may God protect our troops. You're the best. You're the best. You really are the best. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
President Joe Biden promised to be the most pro-worker and pro-union president in American history, and he has taken numerous steps to keep that promise. Let's review those this Labor Day. Recent polls show support for unions at its highest level in more than half a century, 68% according to Gallup. The unemployment rate is the lowest in 50 years, the Department of Commerce reports, and a greater share of working-age people have a job today than in more than 20 years. Inflation-adjusted income is up 3.5% since the president took office, and the largest wage gains over the last 2 years have gone to the lowest-paid workers. Under Bidenomics, America is seeing a historic level of investment in manufacturing, Forbes reports, and new industries to create good-paying jobs that Americans can raise a family on and build a community around. Now, just in time for Labor Day, the Biden-Harris administration has announced new actions to empower workers by investing in America's clean energy workforce, establishing pathways into high-paying and union jobs, demonstrating the benefits of unions, and extending critical wage protections to combat climate change while fueling jobs. The Department of the Treasury and the Internal Revenue Service published a proposed rule to support good-paying jobs in clean energy and workforce development through incentives in the Inflation Reduction Act. Many of the new law's clean energy deployment tax incentives are increased by 5 times if taxpayers pay workers prevailing wages and use registered apprentices. The Department of Energy opened applications for the $2 billion Domestic Manufacturing Conversion Grants Program created by the Inflation Reduction Act. This will provide funding for auto manufacturers transitioning to electric vehicles. The Department of Energy Loan Programs Office is also facilitating access to $10 billion in capital for auto factory conversions, prioritizing areas with a long history of automaking, strong workforce practices, and labor standards. The Department of Energy is releasing a second round of grants to expand domestic manufacturing of batteries for electric vehicles and the nation's grid, as well as for battery materials and components currently imported from other countries. The administration has also released a report showing that unions help grow the economy by reducing inequality, raising incomes, increasing savings, including retirement savings, and broadening home ownership. According to the report, union members make higher wages and are more likely to earn critical benefits like retirement, health care, child care, life insurance, and sick leave. The Department of Labor also released a proposed rule that would extend overtime to about 3.6 million more Americans by raising the overtime salary threshold from under $36,000 a year to roughly $55,000 a year. These actions build on historic support for workers and unions since Biden took office. What are some of those steps? In August, the Department of Labor published a final rule updating the Davis-Bacon Act, prevailing wage standards for the first time in nearly 40 years. The rule affects over a million workers constructing $200 billion in federally funded or assisted construction projects who will receive higher wages over time. The Biden-Harris administration has recovered over $690 million for more than 440,000 low-paid workers across the nation by enforcing laws that protect these workers from being victims of wage theft and exploitation when they were not paid minimum wage or overtime, were denied tips, or misclassified as independent contractors. Recently, the Department of Labor relaunched the Worker Organizing Resource and Knowledge, or WORK, Center. While more than half of non-union workers say they want a union, only about 10% of these workers say they know how to form one. The Work Center meets the needs of workers who are seeking more information about their labor rights and lack experience in organizing. To create a pathway to good-paying jobs, the Biden-Harris administration invested a historic $285 million in registered apprenticeships in fiscal year 2023, and in July, they awarded over $65 million in grants to 45 states to expand and diversify registered apprenticeships in high-demand industries. The administration also launched the Apprenticeship Ambassadors Initiative to boost apprenticeships with private and public sector employers. In March, the Department of Labor launched the Mega Construction Project Program, initially designating 12 projects funded by the infrastructure law as mega projects, providing help to construction project owners, contractors, and unions to ensure equal employment opportunities for underrepresented workers. Also in March, the Department of Labor announced a $20 million cooperative agreement with Trades Futures in partnership with the National Urban League to increase the number of participants from underrepresented populations and underserved communities in registered apprenticeship programs in the construction industry. In April, President Biden issued an executive order directing all cabinet-level agencies with federal job creation funds to encourage grantees to fund supportive services, including child care and long-term care. This action aims to help underserved workers enroll in and complete training, then transition to good jobs, including union jobs. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
American labor has come a long way. In 1900,
it wasn't unusual for children like me to work 60 hours a week.
People worked without hard hats or ventilators or safety harnesses.
And if your boss didn't pay you, there wasn't much you could do.
Millions of American workers
and unions
and lawmakers
and advocates have worked tirelessly to significantly change all that.
Maybe you're thinking,
bruh, what about all these stories I've seen about children in dangerous jobs?
And adults in hot trucks, and all these people on strike.
That is what Labor Day is all about.
We're seeing these stories because people are saying,
hey, this is a problem, and we need to fix it.
That's the work we do at the Labor Department every day, and we don't do it alone.
There are so many people out there.
Workers.
And union members and advocates.
Who see the way things are and say,
this could be better.
And then they make it happen.
We don't celebrate Labor Day because work is perfect.
We celebrate the work in progress.
We celebrate the workers.
And the vision.
And the effort that goes into securing
that better future.
This has been a public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Labor.
While Democrats are celebrating Labor Day by touting their achievements to protect workers, praising the actions of unions to protect workers' livelihoods and safety, and introducing new pro-worker proposals, California Republicans led by Carl DeMaio's Reform California sent out an anti-labor message. Specifically, the Republicans' message states, on this Labor Day, let's not make the mistake of celebrating labor unions in California. Instead, DeMaio says he wants to get union money out of California politics. Without citing any evidence, he blames corrupt union bosses for costing workers jobs. DeMaio's group opposes workers having to pay union dues to unions that may support pro-labor Democrats. DeMaio's group is fighting against project labor agreements, which require government construction projects be awarded to businesses with collective bargaining agreements, comply with all federal and state labor laws, pay prevailing wages, and have workers pay union dues. PLAs are designed to assure that workers are paid fairly. But DeMaio claims no one should be banned from bidding on a job if they don't want their workers to join a union. His Reform California is pushing for a ballot measure that would repeal project labor agreements, or PLAs. The measure would also repeal AB 5, the controversial law authored by former labor leader and assemblymember Lorena Gonzalez. AB 5 makes it harder for businesses and nonprofit organizations to hire independent contractors. AB 5 was touted as a way to force companies like Uber and Lyft to make their drivers employees and pay them fair wages. But those companies fought back in court and won the right to exempt app-based workers. The law, which was backed by unions, has drawn opposition from small businesses as well as from many independent contractors in fields such as the music industry. But while repealing AB 5 might have substantial support among California voters, DeMaio may have overreached by also including repeal of project labor agreements, which have widespread support among workers seeking higher wages and those who support workers' rights. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Goetz.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Just a great time and opportunity to fellowship with workers throughout the state and, you know, just to pay homage and respect to what labor has done for this country.
Josh Sword, president of the West Virginia AFL-CIO, is one of many celebrating Labor Day. A new Gallup poll finds 2 out of 3 Americans approve of organized labor. That's near a 20-year high. And just in time for the holiday, the National Labor Relations Board gave labor a big victory, returning to a long-standing policy that an employer who interferes with a union election has to immediately recognize the union and enter bargaining. Meanwhile, Kaiser Permanente workers have reluctantly voted to strike. Years of bargaining have reached an impasse over staffing levels and higher wages. But Kevin Darden, who works at Kaiser Permanente's Sunnyside Medical Center, says Oregon's recently passed safe staffing law could settle some questions.
With this safe staffing law, we'll be able to actually hold Kaiser accountable and be able to say, listen, this is the amount of employees that we need to meet these patient demands, and these are going to be our patient-to-employee ratios.
When Congress returns, some on the Republican right flank are looking to begin an impeachment inquiry into President Joe Biden. Numerous articles of impeachment were introduced by Florida Republican Representative Greg Stube in August and by Lauren Boebert of Colorado in July. At a town hall event, Georgia Republican Marjorie Taylor Greene said she won't vote for a budget without an impeachment inquiry.
I'm not going to continue to fund the Biden regime's weaponized government, so there should be no funding for Jack Smith's special counsel.
Not long after Greene made these comments, the White House said the last thing Americans need is for the most extreme House members to trigger a government shutdown. While addressing reporters at FEMA's headquarters, President Joe Biden said he's eager to avoid a budget crisis that would hamper the agency's work in Florida.
It would be a serious, serious problem. I'm hoping that there's greater maturity to prevent that from happening than something.
Biden says he's looking for a short-term continuing resolution to help work out the larger budget issues. The White House also wants $40 billion in additional spending, including more money for FEMA and $24 billion for Ukraine. After Minority Leader Mitch McConnell froze in the middle of a public speech for the second time, many, including some Republican presidential candidates, are saying he should step down. William Cole, author of the upcoming book, The Big 100, The New World of Super Aging, says the country is becoming a gerontocracy.
When you have very old leaders, they're preoccupied with issues that are more top of mind to them.
The average age in the Senate is now 64, and the average age in the House is 57. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Workers in Santee are getting a raise. The Santee City Council has approved a series of 2-year pay hikes for its unionized firefighters and also gave all employees, including city council members, raises for the next 2 years. The city's firefighters are getting 4% more pay retroactive to July 1st and then a 6% market adjustment salary hike starting January of next year and another 4% cost of living increase next July. Councilman Rob McNellis said the 6% market adjustment to the pay hikes was agreed to because the city wants to make sure it won't be losing firefighters to nearby cities that pay higher salaries. The rest of Santee's employees, from the city manager to the lowest paid full-time person, will be getting a 4% cost of living increase starting July 6th this year and another 4% increase beginning next July. Santee's 5 elected officials get their cost of living raises starting August 31st and another 4% starting next July. In addition, the officials will get increased car allowances. According to its operating budget, Santee has 138 full-time equivalent employees. Santee's highest paid official, city manager Marlene Best, receives an annual salary of over $252,000. 5 others earn over $150,000 a year. Once the pay hikes are factored in, Santee's operating budget increases by about $1 million to $57.3 million for fiscal year 2023-24. But even with the added expenses, the city has a total reserve balance of about $13 million, or 23.6% of its revenues, and that's well above the target of 20%, which the council previously set. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ in Santee, this is Miriam Raftery.
California's ongoing teacher shortage is fueling interest in joining the new Interstate Compact for Teachers, which would smooth the way for out-of-state teachers to work in the Golden State. 10 states have signed the compact so far. A bill for California to join them has passed the state Senate and is expected to be taken up by the Assembly Education Committee during the next session in January. Adam Deersing is with the National Center for Interstate Compacts, part of the Council of State Governments.
The compact is mostly designed to reduce the strain and the individual burden on teachers who are required to produce a great level of documentation, retake examinations that they took earlier in their career, and relitigate their experience in the new state.
California faced a shortage of 10,000 teachers over the 2021-22 school year. But the California Teachers Association opposes the bill, saying it is unnecessary, as California already has a process to hire teachers from other states. Deersing says the compact started as a way to help military spouses find work when their families are transferred, but opponents worry about a potential brain drain.
Some states are concerned that their teachers will utilize the compact to leave. Frankly, we don't foresee that being an issue, but that hasn't been an issue with existing licensure compacts that we've seen.
Another bill in the California legislature, Senate Bill 765, would make it easier for retired teachers to re-enter the workforce. California also offers an Earn While You Learn program to train new teachers. However, a recent report found that applications for teaching credentials had fallen by 16% last year. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week. This is Miriam Raftery with this week's Destination East County. Fall is in the air, ushering in some of East County's most iconic festivals, including Oktoberfests, Alley Cat Art Walk, Julian Autumn Jubilee, Saquon Powwow, and haunting Halloween happenings. Plus, comedians Randy Rainbow and Paula Poundstone will be performing in El Cajon, and music legend Crystal Gayle will be on stage at Saquon. The 2023 Saquon Powwow will be held September 8th through 10th at the Saquon Resort in El Cajon. The annual celebration will feature tribal dancing contests each day, as well as bird singing competitions on September 9th. Other activities include peon games at dusk, traditional Native American arts and crafts, vendors, and refreshments. You can find more information at the Saquon Powwow page on Facebook. Country music legend Crystal Gayle will perform at Saquon's Live and Up Close Theater on Saturday, September 9th at 8 p.m. She was inducted into the Grand Ole Opry in 2017 by her sister, Loretta Lynn. Her signature songs include Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue, You've Been Talking in Your Sleep, When I Dream, Half the Way, and her duet with Eddie Rabbit, Just You and I. Gayle has released over 20 number one hits and has been awarded many times by the Grammys, the Country Music Association, the Academy of Country Music, American Music Awards, and the American Music Operators Association. For tickets, you can visit Saquon.com. Galleries and businesses in downtown El Cajon invite you to the 12th annual Alley Cat Art Walk on Friday, September 15th from 4 to 8 p.m. This event is held along Main Street and Rhea Avenue in downtown El Cajon. Visitors can see fine art, a jewelry art show, crafts, giftware, live music, and refreshments. The event is open to the community. You can find details at downtownelcajon.com. The Julian Autumn Jubilee will be each weekend from September 23rd through October 29th. You can enjoy Julian's famous apple season with activities that also include a hayride, cider pressing demonstration, hoedown, jug band show, petting zoo, pumpkin patch, reptile interactions, candle dipping, and painting. There's also an adventure package option if you want to try your hand at archery and tomahawk throwing. Other options include new pick veggies, herbs and berries, fairy and dinosaur garden crafts, and more. For tickets and details, you can visit fortcross.com. From September 29th through October 1st, La Mesa Oktoberfest will be celebrating 50 years of Bavarian festivities in an effort to top its traditions for the past half a century. Festivities will include three stages of nonstop music, featuring everything from traditional Bavarian and German music to live oompa bands, traditional rock bands, DJs, cover pop, and more, plus German cuisine and multiple beer gardens. The family fun event also features dachshund races, a kinder carnival, Ferris wheel, rock climbing wall, Gluck games, an artisan market and food fair, Deutsch Dance Square, and keg tapping ceremony. For a schedule of events and beer garden tickets, you can visit lamesaoktoberfest.org. Paula Poundstone will be performing at the Magnolia in El Cajon on Friday, September 29th at 6:30 p.m. The iconic comedian has starred in several HBO specials, hosts a weekly comedy podcast called Nobody Listens to Paula Poundstone, and is a panelist on NPR's comedy news quiz show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She was the first female comic to perform stand-up comedy at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. Her HBO special, Cats, Cops, and Stuff, marked the first time a female comedian won Best Comedy Special in the Cable Ace Awards. For tickets, you can visit concerts.livenation.com. The German-American Societies of San Diego will host two weekends of Oktoberfest at its El Cajon headquarters on September 29th through October 1st and again October 6th through 8th. An opening day parade and keg tap kicks off the festivities Friday evening, September 29th, when the Oktoberfest queen will be crowned. Direct from Germany, the band Die Guggenbachbaum will perform traditional German music just as you'd hear in the beer gardens in Bavaria. You can also watch folk dancing, compete in games and contests, visit craft vendors, and take children to a kids' zone. Plus, savor authentic German food such as bratwurst, ox on the spit, potato salad, potato pancakes, sauerkraut, red cabbage, and German pastries, and of course, German beers. A raffle will also be held, and the grand prize is a trip for two to Germany. Tickets are available online at events.germanclubsandiego.org. The Randy Rainbow for President comedy show is coming to the Magnolia Theater in El Cajon on October 14th. Randy Rainbow is a three-time Emmy-nominated American comedian, producer, actor, singer, writer, and satirist, best known for his popular YouTube series, The Randy Rainbow Show. His musical parodies and political spoofs have garnered him worldwide acclaim and two Emmy nominations. In 2019, he landed a spot on the New York Times Best Performances list, and in 2020, The Washington Post proclaimed Rainbow as Best Parody. For tickets, you can visit MagnoliaSanDiego.com. El Cajon presents HauntFest on Main, a family-friendly Halloween season festival on Friday, October 20th from 4 to 9 p.m. in downtown El Cajon. The 10th annual HauntFest on Main features live music on two stages plus other performances, costume contests, expanded carnival rides and games, a car show, candy challenge, kids zone, face painting, pumpkin patch, craft and game booths, LED rock wall, inflatables for kids, plus a surprise feature of movies in the park. You can get more information at hauntfest.org. The 57th annual Borrego Days Desert Festival, produced by the Borrego Chamber of Commerce, will be held October 21st to 22nd at Christmas Circle Community Park in Borrego Springs. This festival includes live musical entertainment, art exhibits, a kids' zone, food vendors, artisans, a beer garden, a car show, and more. For details, visit borregodays.com. Lions, Tigers, and Bears in Alpine invites you to two wildly eerie events, a family-friendly pumpkin bash on October 29th and a spooky camp over October 28th through 29th. These events sell out quickly, so early reservations are recommended. You can camp out in the countryside and sleep under the stars with the sanctuary animals during the annual Spooky Camp Over fundraiser. This family-friendly spooktacular overnight event includes campfire songs, pumpkin carving, a Halloween costume contest, and an all-ages haunted house. Enjoy the fun of the Animal Trivia Challenge, make s'mores by the campfire, and sip hot cocoa at the Big Cat and Wildlife Sanctuary. The next morning is their pumpkin bash during the morning sanctuary visit. Come dressed in your best costume and watch the rescued big cats and bears devour their pumpkin treats. Pumpkins carved by campers the night before are stuffed with all kinds of delicious goodies. This event will take place rain or shine. For tickets and details, you can visit lionstigersandbears.org. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions from San Diego's East County.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf. We interview creative minds and share their ideas. Here's your host, Annette Tour.
Welcome to the East County Magazine Bookshelf. Today, it is truly my honor to introduce my guest, Bruce Givner. Givner was only 21 years old at the time, working as an intern at the Democratic National Committee's Watergate offices. He is best known for his role on the evening of the Watergate burglary. His presence substantially delayed the break-in and indirectly led to the eventual arrest of the burglars. He is an American attorney holding a major in history from UCLA, and he went on to study law at Columbia University, specializing in tax law at New York University. He has been featured in many books and articles, such as Harper's and the McCord Files. Today, I'm excited to talk to you about his book, My Watergate Scandal Tell-All, How I Unwittingly Caused This Historic Event. Welcome to the show, Mr. Bruce Givner. It's such an honor to have you here.
Thank you very much, Annette, for that lovely introduction.
You're welcome. In your book, you share your memories of your time as an intern before the Watergate scandal. Can you share a few of those memories? What were your responsibilities and experiences during that period?
Well, the first thing I did when I got to D.C. was I bought a motorcycle. I had one at UCLA, and it was pretty helpful getting around. D.C. is a pretty small place, and on a motorcycle, you could make it around there very quickly. When I showed up at the DNC on Monday of that week, which was the fateful week, it was the first week I was there that the break-in occurred. Anyway, when I showed up at the DNC that first week, because I had a motorcycle, they used me as a messenger, as a courier, and I was taking packages up to the Hill. I went into the offices of senators and members of the House of Representatives. So that was pretty cool for me. It was very enjoyable that first week.
That sounds pretty impressive. I wonder if you were wondering what were in those documents that you were...
Yes. Yep, you always wondered, didn't you? They were sealed and you had to... People had to sign on to them and stuff. It wasn't terribly, it was just a little string, basically, but wasn't supposed to look in, and I did not.
Fascinating. The incident of burglars watching you, making free long-distance phone calls, is quite intriguing. Can you elaborate on that story?
Well, in these old days, there was something called a Watts line, which is a wide area telephone service. And there were national ones and there were relatively local ones. And since I was from Ohio, my family had moved to LA when I graduated from high school. I decided that first week I was going to take advantage of the free phone calls. And I stayed late that Friday night. People cleared out about 7. The last people were there. And so I went and started using the phone call, the phone line. And I was calling people in Ohio and I was calling people in LA. And it was fun. You know, I got to talk to, you know, friends, girlfriends from Ohio, from L.A. And I think anyway, I was done about midnight. I was there in the offices and you couldn't leave the offices without having a key to get back in, which of course I didn't have because I wasn't important. And the bathroom was out there in the hallway. So I couldn't leave to go use the bathroom. So I walked out onto the balcony overlooking Virginia Avenue, and they had planters there. So I took a pee into one of the planters facing Howard Johnson's, which is where the burglars were. So nobody ever mentioned that they saw that kid take a pee in the planter. So I was very happy with that.
I remember reading that in your book and I was laughing. I mean, using the flower boxes for a bathroom break as a touch of humor to this tension-filled narrative. Your book provides unique insights into the Watergate scandal. What motivated you to write a tell-all book, and what do you hope readers will take away from your perspective?
Well, what motivated me was my publicist, Cherie Kerr. I mean, she said, you know, Bruce, it's the 50th anniversary in 1972 to 2022. You really should write this. And oh, by the way, look at how current events are going. By the way, I'm not going to make any political comments. She was just saying, hey, look what's going on. And so had I been forced to write it myself, it would not have happened. So basically, I sent emails to Cherie and I talked to her a lot, and she wrote the book. I mean, I didn't really write it. So it's my stories, but a lot of it is Cherie's recollection of the culture of the time. I don't think my story is that interesting. She thinks it is. So it's very much her book about what happened to me, both at the break-in, but there was stuff that happened later. I mean, I was interviewed by the head of the Republican Senate Watergate Committee, Fred Thompson, who later became a senator and later became a TV and a movie star. He was in, I can't remember what the name of that movie was, but in a very big blockbuster movie. And he was frequently appeared in some very long-running TV show. So
was it All the President's Men?
I wish I remembered or not. If you've got a computer, you can look it up. But Fred Thompson was, I mean, he became quite the, you know, TV and movie personality. But he wasn't at the time. He was just a lawyer on the Republican Senate Watergate Committee. My takeaway, you know, primarily was just the very, very sad what happened to Frank Wills, the guard who discovered the tape twice, not once. The first time before he and I walked across the street to the Howard Johnson's to get milkshakes and cheeseburgers. The second time, obviously, we went back and he found the tape again. And that's what motivated him to call his supervisor, which brought the police there, which resulted in the arrest. But I mean, he was just abused. There was a guy who promised to help him get speeches, and he died in poverty. And it was very sad. That just was awful.
That is so unfortunate to hear and tragic about Frank Wills, that despite his pivotal role, he faced a difficult life of poverty. Very sad indeed. Why were you called the mystery man?
Well, the author of the article in the New York Times asked Frank Wills about me, and Frank didn't know anything about me, and he certainly wasn't involved in any of the news about the event. And the guy who wrote the article was lazy. He didn't look and see that I'd been interviewed by the Washington, D.C. police, the Secret Service, the FBI, the Senate Watergate Committee. So he just posted. It was funny because the article was called Frank Wills, A Footnote to History. There was one footnote in the column in the entire article, and it was about the mystery man. So I was the footnote to the footnote to history. So I wrote him. I said, wait a minute. There was no mystery. I was interviewed by all these people. So he printed a retraction, and they printed my article, my letter.
Can you describe the atmosphere and tension at the Watergate complex leading up to the scandal? How did your presence there change after the burglary incident?
So in the first week I was there, there was no real tension. We were doing what we were supposed, the volunteers were doing what we were supposed to do, which was to put together the committee hearings around the country. The way the platforms are assembled is by people testifying. There would be one hearing, I'm making this up because I don't remember, in St. Louis. There'd be one in Michigan. There'd be one in California. So I helped reserve the rooms and make sure the speakers were ready and they knew how long they had to talk. There wasn't really any tension. Things were just going business as usual. And after the burglary incident, no one really knew anything for the time period. It didn't really explode until quite a lot later. The next year, I was at Exeter College in Oxford on another summer program. And I remember going downstairs in the basement and watching TV, which was the Senate Watergate hearings. And so it really took a while to get going.
In your book, you discuss the impact of the Watergate scandal on political and public perceptions. How do you believe this event has shaped the course of American history and politics?
Well, I want to be very careful what I say. So let me just say that briefly, at the time, a president's criminal acts had consequences. And that's all I think I'm going to say on the topic.
Okay. That's fair. Could you elaborate on the significance of the break-in and subsequent events in relation to the role of media and investigative journalism during that time, particularly from your perspective on how these events transformed investigative journalism?
Well, that was 5 decades ago, and there was, you know, there were a lot of newspapers. I mean, the LA Times was a big newspaper. It had offices around the world. Well, that's not the case. The LA Times is holding on by its fingernails. If you read the LA Times today, a lot of those stories are just from Bloomberg. I mean, they don't really have their own bureaus anymore. If they do, it's not obvious to me. Mm-hmm. How many newspapers are there in this country today? The New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal. I don't know that there's a whole lot of other, I'm not familiar with every state. The decline of the LA Times shows you a lot about what there is in investigative journalism, because only the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, I'm sorry, those three, New York Times, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, can really afford investigative journalism. So it's pretty bad all these years later. Most people get their news from MSNBC, CNN, Fox.
I agree with you. I think the decline of the newspapers, and now most people probably get their news from social media, unfortunately. Yep. What challenges did you face during the process of writing your tell-all book, both in terms of gathering accurate information and navigating potential legal or ethical considerations?
Well, in terms of gathering accurate information, I was really just relying on my own memory of, because that's what the book is. It's about Bruce, you know, what did I do? You know, what happened to me? Not really that much happened to me. I mean, there was one time I remember, I don't know if you remember, it's in the book. I got a call and this one journalist said that I think is actually in here someplace, that I was a secret agent for the Republicans. And I went, really? That's okay. That's interesting.
That is interesting.
He said, well, you arrived right before the break-in. I said, well, that's absolutely true. He said, we think your ticket was paid for by the Republican National Committee. I said, lots of luck on that. So that was sort of interesting. But in terms of ethical considerations, I don't really have anything because I didn't know anything that was privileged. So it's not like, you know, again, I was just telling what happened to me while I was there. So.
Did you ever feel like your life was in danger, entangled in this scandal?
And that shows you the difference between then and now, doesn't it? Again, not making a political point, but people are a lot more active with their views nowadays, aren't they?
Americans surveyed after the Watergate scandal had less trust in government. Did the events surrounding the Watergate scandal influence your views on government transparency and accountability?
Well, I think my views are informed by what's going on in the world today. I mean, we've got the rise of autocrats, and I don't think this has anything to do with the United States. If you look around the world, you look at Viktor Orban in Hungary, you look at Recep Tayyip Erdogan in Turkey, and you look at, this might be too hot to say, Bibi Netanyahu in Israel. And there are others, without a doubt. I'm not mentioning Vladimir Putin. That's probably dangerous to say. So, I mean, the rise of the autocrats is pretty scary in this world, isn't it?
Yes, it is. What were your emotions as a young individual being involved in a pivotal moment of history and becoming entangled in a scandal that captured the entire nation's scrutiny?
Well, as I said, when I was there in D.C. at the time, there was really nothing happening. After D.C., I went down to Florida because that's where the convention was, and that was fun. But there was nothing going on as to the break-in. The following year, as I said, when I was in Oxford, it was there on TV, but nothing really had happened yet. Now, when I started law school at Columbia, I started getting interviewed. And that's when they called me to D.C. But in terms of when it was blowing up, I was in law school. And let me tell you, when you're in law school, at least for me, it took every ounce of my being to survive law school. It was very, very difficult. So I didn't have a whole lot of attention going off to other things. There was the article in the school newspaper, which was entitled, "But for Him, Nixon Might Still Be President." So that was funny, interesting, but, you know, not a whole lot pierced inside of trying to go to school and survive in school. By the way, I had a professor of women in law. Yeah. And the professor's name was Ruth. Guess the next two words I'm going to say. Ruth Ginsburg. She was my professor. 8 o'clock in the morning. I always fell asleep. She was the most boring professor.
Oh, my goodness.
Really smart, but boring as hell. Her husband, Marty Ginsburg, was a tax lawyer. One of the most brilliant. I mean, he was incredibly brilliant and a great public speaker and writer.
What unbelievable history. So you just mentioned that you were the only subject in Columbia Law School News, if not for him, Nixon might still be president, by Jim Shaw. Do you think there would have been a Watergate scandal had you not stayed late to make these calls? Perhaps Nixon would have remained president?
Well, I think that I helped because I got Frank out. And then as soon as he got back, he had a fresh look at it. I don't. But on the other hand, you know, if you watched one of the TV specials, it said that they had already tried 3 times to break in, right? So if they'd missed that one, the 4th time, who knows? They might have gone back a 5th time and a 6th time until they were finally, successful. And maybe Frank wouldn't have been on duty. Maybe there would have been someone else who hadn't been as just acting within the course and scope of his job as Frank did. So I wish I could take some credit for it. but not sure I can.
Well, you may have delayed the process. And, you know, sometimes it's just a perfect combination of events happening just to create the moment. Looking back, what lessons do you think we can learn from the Watergate scandal? And how can they be applied to contemporary political and social?
I'm going to stay away from contemporary events. Certainly, you got to be careful when there's a tape recording going. When there's a tape recorder going, you better watch. And what I tell clients, by the way, as a tax lawyer, I said, whenever you enter a room, you should assume that you are being tape recorded. What I tell the young lawyers in the firm is when someone comes in, a client or potential client, you should assume that it's an undercover IRS criminal investigation division agent, and they are recording you. You always have to be on your best behavior. When clients walk into my office and they say something I don't like, I say, that is criminal tax fraud. Because if there's someone listening to it, I want it to be clear that I told them that they can't do it. So, you know, A, first of all, do the right thing. You want to do the right thing. And B, you know, watch it. I mean, you don't know who's listening, who's tape recording, and I don't want to talk about current events such that.
Okay, that sounds fair. By the way, I just love, as I was reading the book, you had songs along the way, and it really took me back to that period. I actually listened to all those songs just to bring me back into that period of time. I thought it was just amazing. Is there anything that you would like your readers to know?
It may not look like it, but when I was at UCLA, we were riding our motorcycles an awful lot. And God, those were crazy times. And But for that motorcycle, I wouldn't have seen as much of DC as I did. It was really nice to be able to, I mean, I played golf there was a golf course in downtown DC where you got to look over and see the Lincoln Memorial, and you got to see it was wonderful, the freedom. I don't know if I'd feel that good anymore, and I'm glad my kids never did it. When I was 18 and stupid, it was a lot of fun. So.
Well, Mr. Givner, reading your book about the Watergate scandal was not only enlightening, but also quite a page turner. I'm truly grateful for the opportunity to have you on the show and to have learned so much about this important part of history. So I want to show everyone the book again. It is my Watergate Scandal Tell All.
Cherie Kerr's name is right there. Make sure everybody understands that. Oh. The cultural references, the songs were largely Cherie.
Okay, so that's good to know. So by Bruce Givner with Cherie Kerr. Thank you so much for being on the show. And
I wish you success
in your future endeavors.
Thank you. Have a lovely day.
Thank you. You too.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. on the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. Undercover officers with the San Diego Regional Auto Theft Task Force infiltrated organized auto theft rings locally, leading to the recovery of 172 stolen cars in East County and 50 people charged with crimes, says Captain Charles Leonard with the California Highway Patrol. Through a sting operation at a storefront at an undisclosed East County location, suspects were caught on video selling stolen vehicles, guns, ammunition, and narcotic drugs to undercover detectives. On August 31st, the task force announced that Operation Sunrise has resulted in recovery of stolen vehicles worth about $3.3 million. The 50 suspects were indicted on crimes including auto theft, identity theft, illegal firearms possession, and selling drugs. Officers also seized narcotics and 14 firearms, including several untraceable and illegal ghost guns. La Mesa Police Chief Ray Sweeney, the task force's executive chair, says cracking down on auto thefts is important because stolen cars are often used to commit other crimes. Chief Sweeney says most ATM thefts are done with stolen vehicles, as well as most street robberies, 10 News reports. All of the stolen vehicles have been returned to their owners. The San Diego District Attorney's Office recommends that vehicle owners use an alarm and or a GPS tracking device to aid in recovery in case your vehicle is stolen. The San Diego County Regional Auto Theft Task Force, or RAT, was formed in 1992. It's comprised of police officers, sheriff's deputies, CHP investigators, probation officers, FBI special agents, the National Insurance Crime Bureau, district attorney investigators, assistant United States attorneys, and more. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show, and now it's time for the Sounds of History.
In July, San Diego County Supervisors unanimously voted to approve the honorary naming of four bridges to commemorate some pioneering leaders in East County. The request was made by District 2 Supervisor Joel Anderson in response to requests from community members. Petitions were signed by at least 100 residents and approved by each community's planning or sponsor group. Supervisors also approved $4,000 from the Community Enhancement Program budget to fund two signs at each bridge. Each nominee was researched by the Office of Equity and Racial Justice. According to Supervisor Anderson, this board letter honors individuals that embodied equity principles by providing their respective communities with opportunity, fair treatment, and advancement for all. These individuals spent the majority of their lives and careers working with underserved and disadvantaged groups. Two of the bridges are on historic Highway 80 in Hakumba. One will be named after Bert Vaughn, Hakumba's founding father, who bought 320 acres in 1918. He developed the town into a world-class resort that once attracted Hollywood celebrities. Amenities included the Hotel Vaughn, a dance hall, mineral bathhouse, stores, and an auto shop and restaurants. Vaughn also provided water and electricity to the town's residents and donated land for a schoolhouse and church. In addition, he built the Desert View Tower, now a California historical landmark, and was appointed by the governor to serve as the state's highway commissioner, overseeing major highway improvements in our region. The second bridge in Hakumba will honor Patricia Faubel, who served as fire chief in Hakumba's volunteer fire department from 1984 through 1999, before most fire departments had female firefighters. She and her crew responded to many fires as well as medical calls. She also oversaw the district's transition to become part of the Rural Fire Protection District, which today is part of the San Diego County Fire Department. Patricia was an active member of the Hakumba Women's Club and Friends of the Hakumba Library. In addition, this powerhouse woman served for many years on the Hakumba Community Service District's Board of Directors, as well as volunteering as a poll worker on election days. A bridge on Buckman Springs Road in Campo will be renamed to honor pioneer Isola Hook. Born Isola Derrick, she came to Campo from Texas with her parents, who were homesteaders. After her father was shot and killed, she cared for her younger siblings while her mother worked at a hotel. In 1895, she married Charles Hook, a local rancher. Isola rode with him on cattle drives to Imperial County. On their ranch, they raised 6 children, as well as cattle, poultry, and hogs. She could ride a horse, chop wood, plant a garden, cook, and can her own fruits and vegetables. She later served as a Glencoe school trustee, volunteered at a hospital, served as president of the Mountain Empire Home Center Group, and was an active member of the San Diego Cowbells, the county's pioneer society. The Pine Valley Creek Bridge on historic Highway 80 will honor Charles Judson. In 1923, Judson purchased 1,200 acres in Pine Valley to develop a mountain resort. He then built a restaurant, general store, auto shop, riding stables, golf course, swimming pool, tennis courts, and rustic rental cabins. He also donated the land for the Pine Valley School, started the Pine Valley Water Company, and subdivided parts of the valley into lots for homes. Though the Judson family sold their holdings in 1958, he also donated the land for the Pine Valley School, started the Pine Valley Water Company, and subdivided parts of the valley into lots for homes. Though the Judson family sold their holdings in 1958, the Pine Valley House restaurant still exists, as do many of the cabins, reflecting Charles Judson's lasting vision and legacy 100 years later. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Derek Wilton.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This is Miriam Raftery, producer of the East County Magazine radio show. If you would like to be the media, here's your opportunity. We're looking for some more talented volunteers for our East County Magazine radio show. So if you've got radio experience or just a great voice, or if you'd like to get experience writing scripts or special reports for the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, we'd like to hear from you. You can call us at 619-698-7617 or send an email to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We're your community media, bringing you news from our region that reflects the public interest, not special interests.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.